Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. This series will include 15 podcasts in total, so if you enjoyed today's show, be sure to check out some of the others. Each podcast is going to explore a different topic related to heritage conservation in different regions of Ontario. The podcast will include a brief history of the building, interviews with people who have some connection to this space, but the ultimate goal is to try and tell stories about the buildings, stories about the space that most people don't know. Each one is going to be different, because the truth is, each building has a different past, and each building has a different story to tell us. So without further ado, let's get started on today's topic. Today we head to southwestern Ontario and into the city of Waterloo. Waterloo is part of what is called the Tri-City, which consists of Cambridge, Kitchener, and Waterloo. Now, since Kitchener and Waterloo flow right into each other almost seamlessly, it is also known to many as KW. However, each have their own government, and they've never been formally amalgamated, despite many attempts. According to the City of Waterloo's official webpage, the Waterloo area was settled by Abraham Erb in 1806. Erb was a Mennonite from Pennsylvania who purchased 896 acres of land from the German Tract Company. In 1816, he built a sawmill on Beaver Creek, which is known today as Laurel Creek. He also had the only grist mill in the area, so many farmers came from miles around to get their wheat ground into flour at his mill. Some consider this the beginning for the area becoming an important commercial and social center. Erb named his settlement Waterloo Township after the famous Battle of Waterloo. Now, the area was slow to grow, however, because he refused to sell or divide his land into smaller lots. However, this was finally accomplished in 1850 after the land had passed into different ownership. Now, as I mentioned, Erb was a Mennonite from Pennsylvania. The Mennonite community remains an important and integral part of the regional culture, and the community is still very active in the area. Along with the Erb family, there were also many other important founding families in the region. One of them was the Eby family, who plays a key role in the building we are going to talk about today. The building we are going to focus on is known as the Eby Hallman House. If you Google the Eby Hallman House, though, you won't find any information on it. One site done by the City of Waterloo might catch your eye, but don't be fooled by the listing of the Eby Schneider House. It's not the one we're talking about. The Eby Hallman House is no longer found on its original plot. In fact, it no longer lies in the City of Waterloo. It was dismantled and moved to a new location many decades ago. But for those living in the Waterloo area, you might just drive by the home's original site every day. In fact, you might even do your grocery shopping there, and you would have no idea. So how can we know the story about this home? Well, thank goodness for us, there is one woman, Marg Roll, who was part of the final chapters of its life and can tell us a little bit more about its history. Marg is part of the North Waterloo branch of the ACO, and she agreed to meet me one morning at Cafe 1842 in downtown Waterloo. Over our coffee, she pulled out an old-school slide viewer to show me the one photo that exists of the house in its original form, with the family standing in front of it. She also showed me a series of photos of the home being dismantled. Marg also brought along the one and only article that was written about the property in 1975. The article acknowledges an interesting part of the story about the many settlers to the area, and certainly the case with the Eby family. The Mennonite migration from Pennsylvania began in the early 1800s. Some came on foot or horseback, however most traveled in large Conestoga wagons, which were driven by horse or oxen. The exchange of land and the purchase of land was all done from afar. Here is a quote from Marg's 1975 article, which gives us a little bit more detail about these transactions. In 1807, David and Jacob Erb, agents for the company, sold 100 acres for $150 American to George Eby, a relative of Bishop Benjamin Eby. In 1808, Christian Eby bought 38 acres, and Philip and Priscilla Steele bought 100 acres, which they sold to John Eby in 1827. All of these transactions took place in Pennsylvania. So the story goes on. In 1834, John Eby sold his 100 acres to David Eby. I brought this point up with Marg as I found it interesting, and here's what she had to say.
You know, the early Mennonites from Pennsylvania had gone to check it out, and then they decided to buy a huge block of land in the late 1700s, and then they divided it into lots, and various people bought the lots, but they didn't come and see it sometimes before they settled on it. They just trusted that the land was good, and it was. It was covered with trees, so it was a lot of work. It was homesteading, pioneering.
I then asked Marg if she could tell me more about the house specifically.
Yes, it was built by David Eby, who was a Mennonite that came over very early with another group of Mennonites from Pennsylvania in the early 1800s. I believe it was 1807. And he eventually settled in that part of Waterloo, which is the west part of Waterloo. It wouldn't have been Waterloo Village at that time. It would have been Waterloo Township. And he built the house. He must have had a smaller log house at one point, because he didn't build this house as a log house till 1842. And then I believe before 1851, he covered it over with siding, wood siding, because it wasn't fashionable to have a log house. It was old-fashioned, and it meant that maybe you couldn't afford a better house, that you still had a log house, so they covered it with siding. That was often what happened.
The Eby family lived in the home for many decades. It wasn't until 1903 when Irvin C. Hallman bought the house and the farm. The house would not have been considered a grand house. It was a simple Georgian-style home, which is typical and plain, yet very functional. It was meant to be lived in. As Mark says, the Mennonites who built it were not pretentious, and therefore didn't have fancy pediments or fancy columns or any decorative features. Here's Marg again.
Knowing the history of the house, I had gone to see Mr. Hallman before he sold it to the developer, and he took us all through the house. He was also interested in having it not dumped, you know, in a landfill, that it would be reused somewhere else. So he was most cooperative and let us go all through the house, my husband and I and a few other people, and it was interesting.
Since you can't go and see the house for yourself, I'm going to read an excerpt from Marg's article, which paints a picture of the house that she saw the day she had the tour. So here we go. The house has its front door slightly to the left of the center, and one steps directly into what was the dining room. The parlor was to the right, with a spare bedroom behind it. Adjacent to this was the master bedroom. The stairway is on the north wall of the dining room, and the winter kitchen is to the left of this room. This structure is not log, but frame filled with brick. The exterior is boards with clapboard over it. Plaster was put directly over the brick fill, resulting in a moisture problem. It was later lathed and figure metal was put on the ceiling and walls to stop the dampness. Upstairs in the main house, all of the doors to the four bedrooms go off the landing. There was no upstairs or downstairs hallway. A door from the northwest bedroom went into the second floor above the kitchen. This was used for storage. The attic stairs went up from one of the bedrooms at the back. Here the floorboards are 24-inch pine. There is no ridge pole, and the rafters go directly to the peak. The roof boards are of random widths. The basement walls are granite fieldstone that were whitewashed every spring. The 8x14-inch main beam is axe-hewn with a 4x6-inch oak-joist mortised into it. This construction is found between the first and second floor, as well as between the second floor and the attic. The exterior is white clapboard. A second-story porch with a gable roof supported on columns and a bay window beside the front door are later additions. The two small windows, characteristic of Mennonite Georgian architecture, appear in the gable wall ends. In 1914, this farm, plus six others along Hallman Road, were the first to get hydro from the city of Waterloo, thus making the farmer's life a little easier. Now ask Marg how she, as part of the North Waterloo ACO branch, became involved with the property in the first place. Here's what she had to say.
Major Holdings was a developer in Waterloo who owned the land that the house was on. Mr. Hallman had sold it to them, and they wanted it for development, specifically the Beechwood Plaza. So it was in the way of the new Zare store and some of the other stores that they put in. So they knew about us from an earlier house that we had been given. By that, I mean the ACO, if they found an owner for it, then the Major Holdings would contribute some money to the ACO for finding somebody who would remove the house. So that's what happened. We let it be known that the log house was, that the house was log underneath, and that it was available for the taking away, and for a contribution, actually. from them. So the developer gave the house to us to find a new owner, and the owner gave us some money for the house. Not a lot, but at least the house was going to be removed rather than putting the material into a landfill. And there was an interest, there still is, in log buildings to be dismantled and assembled somewhere else. It couldn't stay where it was, and it wasn't going to fit anywhere else in the region. So somebody from the Shelburne area contacted us and said they'd take it apart. So that's how it happened.
Now, the day that Marg and I met in the cafe, she showed me a dozen or so slides on her old school slide viewer. One by one, the slides showed the progression of the deconstruction of the house. It was all done by hand, and they used ropes and pulleys to lower pieces down one by one. They started by removing the siding and exposing the original logs. On an interesting note, David Eby's name and the date of construction was found carved into a log on the second story. It was uncovered when Irvin removed some of the clapboard, which was put up between 1842 and 1851. Next in the deconstruction went the windows, then the chimney, and then the roof. Then each log was numbered and dismantled one by one. There was no nails, as it had been fitted with chinking in the original construction. And once it was all done, they piled it up, put it on a truck, and drove away. Just like that, it was gone. I ended by asking Marg what she thought made this home special to the community, even though it may not reside within the boundaries anymore. She didn't mince words.
It's not special anymore. Yeah. It's a plaza, you know, but at one time it was special because it was the home of a very early settler and an influential settler. David Eby is responsible for the beginnings of the Herb Street Mennonite Church. He also, his son, I believe, donated the land that was diagonally across from here for a cemetery. The cemetery is still there. And then later on, in the late 1800s, the Herb Street Mennonite Church was built. And he was the minister, and he was very influential in doing that.
So there you have it, the story of the E.B. Hallman House. And even though it no longer exists in its original form or footprint, the house lives on in its new form and with new residents living in it. I would like to thank Marg Rohl for taking the time to show me the slides and speaking with me that day about the house. I would also like to acknowledge the City of Waterloo webpage, where I was able to learn more about the history of the settlement in the region. If you want to learn more about the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario and its involvement with the preservation and conservation of buildings all over Ontario, the ACO is celebrating its 80th anniversary by putting together a book. This book will feature 80 buildings the organization has had a hand in saving over the last 80 years. Now, the Building Stories episode you heard today is just one that will be included, but there are many more stories to discover. You can get the book starting in November 2013 by ordering it online at their website. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you to the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Center at the University of Waterloo, the Center for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet at Building Stories, which is BLDG_stories. And of course, you can find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.